Welcome, I'm Moshe Ferber.
And I am Ariel Munafon.
And this is the Silver Lining Podcast, a podcast about security architecture. And today with us, we got Yuval Re'ut, which is the CISO and also the CIO for Riskified, a promising young company that is doing something really, really interesting in the area of e-commerce. And Yuval is here to talk with us about how he turned his monolithic application from one traditional large monolithic environment into microservices. We're going to have an interesting talk. And Yuval, let's begin. Let's talk about you and Riskified for a second. Can you elaborate a little bit about yourself and your position there?
Hi, good morning. So Riskified basically is an e-commerce enablement company. The core competency of the company came through fraud analysis, and that was basically where the company started. And it brought something very new into the space by basically allowing e-commerce merchants to offload the liability and the actual process of approving orders through and looking for fraud to a new generation of products that basically allows them to shift the liability and to automate the whole process of fraud analysis. So let's take a little bit back and look at how things were actually done, let's say 5-7 years ago. Fraud was happening all over the place, right? So we had bots, we have account takeovers, we have stolen credit cards, we have the dark web. All of these things basically really, really generated a lot of fraud on the internet. And so companies had two challenges. One, they have to find this fraud, and that actually creates around between 2-5% of their revenue is basically what comes out to be fraud. And on the second point, it actually drops a lot of their revenue because by not knowing who's a good customer, who's a bad customer, they actually decline a lot of people who are good customers. And so Riskify basically comes into that space and allows two things. One, it takes away the operational challenge of actually doing that because e-commerce merchants know how to sell e-commerce. We know how to do fraud analysis. And we are actually able to approve a lot more of their orders. And so that enables them to A, offload the whole operational aspects of it, and B, we have the ability to find much more fraud. And so that way we save them a lot of money on the thing. The same aspect to that also is that the company itself shifts over the liability to us. So if currently before they use some kind of a fraud analysis company or chargeback guarantee is actually what we call the service, the fraud itself comes into a place where the company has to find it. And if they don't find it, the chargeback itself is something that the merchant has to pay. A lot of people think that the credit card company is who actually takes the process and takes the ownership of it. And that's true in a card present. So when you actually swipe your card in a restaurant or something like that, but when the card is not, it's a card not present transaction, the one who actually bears the liability is the e-commerce merchant. And so Riskified gives a solution that both takes the liability if the transaction comes back as fraudulent, and then the second tape allows them to basically focus on their core competency and not on fraud analysis.
Yeah, great. Now, you are also the CISO, you handle the security, and you're also the CIO, which is, you handle the all IT aspects. Now, this is not the first time that I see this kind of structure in a software as a service company, which is very interesting by itself. I have a feeling this is because those companies are basically had security people before they had their IT. So they had their security guys in place before there was anyone that handles the IT. I mean, when they started to grow up, the IT is basically just the office manager and some kind of external technician. And when the IT starts to grow up, they needed someone. And I think some of them find out that CISO is the good option. Tell us a little bit more about it. I mean, how does being a CISO helps you become a better CIO? How is the process? How does this affect on you?
So I think you touched an interesting subject around how the companies today or how startups actually grow. Today, because of SaaS and cloud and the enablement basically of simplification of a lot of IT, companies actually start growing without somebody or proper IT. And the proper IT actually moved into the areas of cloud, and it's called DevOps. And so the companies start with somebody on the DevOps who doesn't really want to deal with day-to-day IT of installing computers, of taking care of the network in the office. And these things are also a little bit simpler because of SaaS. And so the companies start off, they start with 30, 40, 50 people. And if it's a B2B startup, security actually becomes an issue pretty much in the beginning, because you can't today sell a SaaS service that's supplying another company with a SaaS service without having the ability to basically protect his data, give him the trust that he needs, and actually have the whole security program in place. And that you need to do when you're already 30, 40, 50 people when you're selling your service. At that point in time, when you have 30, 40 employees, IT is not that big of an issue. Business applications isn't that big of an issue. A lot of these things that organizations already need, and that's when actually IT becomes more important. And I think in general, kind of information processes becomes more important when the company starts going into 200, 300 people. Suddenly you understand that you need that whole infrastructure in place for the company itself. And so when I started, basically the company was, 50 people, something like that. And we started building up the security program because it was something that was needed. And I was working a lot with the DevOps team. And there was a person there who was dealing with IT, but it was from a very more of a help desk kind of environment. And as the company grew and started to scale, I think that the ability, because of myself as a CISO, who understood all of the process that was already going in the company, understood, worked with all of the different stakeholders in the company, the ability to work with different vendors, and something that we are already doing heavy as a CISO, I think that really helps you to kind of make the shift into the CIO position, and allows you to kind of see and enable the business even more to another level. Because I think as a CISO in a B2B startup, you're doing a lot of that from the get-go. You're working with the sales teams, you're working with the development teams, you're working with a lot of these teams already, and the shift is much easier.
But the business, who in the business say, okay, we need the CIO right now?
I think it's a mix of things, and I think it really depends on the life of the company. But when the company starts hitting 200, 300 people, everybody understands that something's happening here and it's kind of getting messy. And if somebody isn't really starting to look at this, so onboarding becoming really, really hard, offboarding, you suddenly see that maybe somebody's not closing a permission in some third kind of application, which wasn't really important when you were 10 people, but now that you're 300 people and people are leaving more, and that SaaS service doesn't connect to a single sign-on, so you have to actually manually go and close it. So these processes become a little bit more tight. I think also the borderline between, I'm putting aside DevOps, I'm saying like IT in an environment where things are very SaaS, so like we don't have any servers in the company. We're basically a very strong internet cafe, right? We don't have a lot of technology in the company itself. We just basically need a good, strong internet. And even accessing the network itself doesn't really give you any privileges because you have to continue to do authentication into our cloud environment. So accessing the office network isn't really an issue from a security perspective. That's kind of the way we architected it also. And
no, I think that if I can help you, it's say, okay, we need a CIO when we have too many processes around the people and business that will help the company work better, and not only for a technologic part or a role part. It's need someone that must have a high view about the IT and make it happen better.
I think it also comes into a place where your systems become more important. So financial systems become more important, CRM systems become more important.
Your back office application are growing.
Yeah, so. It's your back office application, but it's also becoming the backbone of the business. And that's where really the business sits, right? You need the ability to be able to bill, send out invoices, pay your suppliers, right? These things are becoming a lot more complicated. They're growing. Your CRM is becoming much more important. You're scaling your... So I think in the life of a startup, there's also like a few different parts, right? So in the beginning, you need to make sure that your business model works and that you can actually do it. You find your first customers, you find your core customers, you build out your core competency. And at that point in time, it's really be able to grow and scale the company. And so that happens both on the technological level, right? So people are saying you need to scale, you need to be able to grow, but it happens also in the business area, right? You need to be able to build up bigger sales teams, bigger business development teams, and be able to enable those teams to work faster and smarter and more intelligent. And that comes basically together to building a technology stack also for the business users of the environment. So I think that's kind of where the role comes into.
Okay. And basically your major project in the last couple of years was moving Riskified from monolithic application into microservices, and this is basically what we came to talk about, the challenges of security that you seen there. But first of all, why the move? I mean, this is a big change for a new company. Why did you have to move? Why did you decide that monolith doesn't work for you anymore?
So I think the it's something in the last year that we're doing is really the starting to do the move. The company, like I said, is growing pretty quickly. And that the enablement to be able to scale the company into the next generation, the next, let's say, 10x of ability to take transactions, to speed up the transactions, to be able to supply our customers with better services, more technology, doesn't really work very well with the ability of the monolith. It also got to the point where you're using a lot of developers, and it's also the same code base. Deployments become a big problem, right? We basically deploy code 5-7 times a day. It's not an issue around like when you deploy code. Deploying code is something that happens all the time. And so when you have a lot of people on the same code base and doing a lot of deployments, you start running into problems. And so it's basically the ability to scale the company, scale the development teams, and continue to grow to be able to match the business needs is where the change of kind of architecture and the change of perception started coming into the company. And it's not a quick process, right? It's not like you kill off your monolith in 3 months and you're done, right? So you start looking for areas that are saying, okay, what is not the core competency of the product? Where can I start branching it out? And that's where you kind of start taking these microservices. We also started seeing a lot of load around databases and stuff like that. So that was also a big trigger to kind of say, okay, we want to break these out, branch it into different databases. Each use case also needs a different data store, a different approach to how you want to use data, save data, and then actually be able to consume the data in an intelligent way. And so that's been kind of the mission of, I think, R&D in general in the company. And as a CISO, that really brought in a lot of challenges because...
Okay, now let's talk about those challenges. Yeah. And I want to remind that we are going to try to lay them out into people, process, and technology. Mm-hmm. This is, we try to do this in this podcast. I mean, try to lay out everything according to those terms. Let's start with this technology. I mean, the move from monolith to microservices, what effect on technologies it had?
The change of technology is very, very vast, right? So I can say that we did have one key factor going for us from the beginning is that we were Dockerized from day one. So the infrastructure or the stack was basically an EC2 server with a single Docker container running the monolith application.
Unmanaged.
What do you mean by unmanaged?
It doesn't have any Kubernetes or anything that is centrally managing.
No, it was basically containers. It was an auto-scaling kind of environment in AWS. Mm-hmm. We had basically, the monolith had different services kind of running inside it. So we did have kind of a breakdown into different services internally. So we had, let's say, a cluster for the API that's coming in. We have a cluster for workers. We had a cluster for mailing. We had a cluster for... etc. A lot of different services. Let's say we have like 15 different types of clusters. And each of those clusters was basically an auto-scaling group that basically ran a single EC2 server with the Docker container with the application running on top. And that was kind of where we started the mission of going to break it out to microservices. And so that was kind of something that was easy for us because we didn't have to first Dockerize the application itself. So that was like one big step that we were already ready for.
This is what I want to say. It seems that it almost at the beginning of the architecture of this monolith, you thought about the second phase, because when I think that people say, think about monolith, think about the applications before a few years.
This is an actual example of how containers doesn't equal microservices, right? Where most people think that it basically equals.
Right. Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah. Containers and microservices are two different things. We were Dockerized mostly for the simplicity of deployment. And so the first person who was there who headed up the DevOps was a very forward-thinking type of person, and he built it completely on Docker from day one. And so that did bridge the gap a lot, because moving to Kubernetes suddenly didn't mean that you have to deal with Dockerizing the whole application. it dealt more with the underlying infrastructure, how you build out the controls, and how you build out the scaling and stuff like that. But the application itself, or the monolith, was Dockerized. And so basically, at that point in time, I think the R&D started looking at what is the first service that we can actually build or move aside that will be the first microservice of the company.
Perfect. And other aspects of technology, I mean, dealing with permissions, IAM permissions, connecting them.
So there were so many aspects. And to be honest, I think we haven't even covered them all at this point in time, because a lot of these things are pretty new. A lot of the controls aren't there. A lot of these projects are open source projects. And some of these things, we were working with an open source project just the other day, and we saw that they're using, we wanted to do authentication with OpenID Connect, and they're using ID tokens instead of access tokens, which is really bad practice. And so you have to really write them, you know, maybe even put in a pull request. So these are things that are kind of all the time kind of structuring. And but I think the main challenges were, first of all, on a very core level, how do you deal with networking? Right, suddenly you have one big cluster with all of your microservices inside, and you have to take the fundamental things that you know from security, right? And you have to bring that in. So networking is a challenge. And we were using Istio to kind of mitigate and create a lot of controls around that.
Sorry, SDO?
Istio.
Istio.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bringing in the IAM role, since I said we had basically a cluster for every type of service that was running, we had IAM roles that the EC2 instance had. So bringing that into the cluster also brought in a lot of challenges, because you don't want to give the underlying EC2 instances basically a role that can do everything that the microservice on top needs to do. And so that was a big challenge. And we basically used Q2IAM, which is basically a proxy for the container or for the pod that's running on the Kubernetes, to be able to use specific IAM roles. And that's how we bridge that area.
So we say the networking,
networking separation, I guess. Yeah. All the pods can talk to each other on Kubernetes. This is where most companies give up when they see this topology.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. There are a few areas around separation that you can do. Istio kind of is coming out as the leader. Again, these are all open source. These are all solutions that are pretty new. So you do have to understand your use case, how you want to separate, what kind of things you want to be able to do. For us, it was very important to allow developers to spin up services very quickly. That is something that I think is the overall kind of goal, I think, to make this thing. It was to really increase the pace of innovation, to increase the ability of developers to put out a new service. If we look at how we were architected, I don't know, like a year ago, to spin up a new microservice, it had to take DevOps person to create a new cluster for you. You had to create a new Git repo. You had to make the new CI/CD to make that whole thing work. The whole process could take 4 or 5 days to actually spin up a new microservice. Security was involved as well in some of the control methods, especially if it was a microservice that needed to get external traffic and not only internal traffic. And so I think Istio brought in a lot of those capabilities onto the cluster itself. You can create pretty detailed rules around networking, and it enables yourself to also mitigate certain controls. So you can say that developers are allowed to spin up a microservice, but it can't get traffic from external traffic and only get internal traffic. And so that's something that we wanted to enable without any intervention from the DevOps team or from the security team. And the reasoning behind that is that in external service, we have additional controls that we want to sometimes put in place. If it's DDoS protection, if it's WAF protection, depending on the technology, depending on what it is, sometimes you want to pen test the service before you put it up. So it really depends on kind of what the service is. But internal services, we kind of wanted to let that work a lot faster.
Okay, so you have different policies if it's external, if it's internal.
Correct.
What about people? I mean, I've been watching you in the last couple of months publishing a career post and looking for DevSecOps, operations. I mean, the change from to microservices, how does this affect your team, the company knowledge, and the people that are required?
So I don't think that's necessarily the change to microservices that's brought the challenge, but I think today in today's world, in the world of infrastructure as a service, we run on AWS, and the ability to be able to do security in those environments, it's very technological. You need to have a lot of hands-on experience, and this experience is something that today I think in general in the market is something that's hard to find. We all know that there's a DevOps shortage in general. Add on top of that somebody who knows how to do security, who's done that, you're looking for some people that don't really exist, right? The classic security people grew up more in the enterprise world. They haven't touched cloud. They have good kind of security controls and methodology, but they have no understanding of the pace that we work in startups and also the technology. I think as the enterprises will move more into the cloud, and we'll see, I think a lot of that shortage might even, the gap will close, because I think more people will understand cloud methodologies and cloud infrastructure. But today, I think it's a really, really big challenge. So we actually opened up a few roles that we're looking for, basically DevSecOps. I think 3-4 months into the search, we changed the job description, and we really moved it more into like a DevOps role or a senior DevOps role. Also understanding while doing interviews that a lot of DevOps, they call themselves DevOps and they don't call themselves security people, but they actually have a lot of the fundamental knowledge that is needed to be a good security person. So maybe they don't have the methodologies, they don't know how to call it in the right jargon for security, but they do have good understanding of operating systems in Linux. They do have good understanding of Docker containers. They do have good understanding of AWS infrastructure, networking. They do have good understanding of how IAM works on AWS. So the core is there. You just have to build on top of that the methodology. And I think that's where I come into play. And we have the ability to kind of bring in the methodology with using people who are more DevOps oriented. And I think in time they'll grow up into good SecOps people.
If we connect it to the last podcast, the first one that we had, we talked a lot about the challenges and the changes of people. And I think that security is a mindset now that should be able that should be used by all people, developers, DevOps, anyone. That was something that in the enterprise, on the old-fashioned people, it wasn't so important because it was really close.
You meant that security used to be a department on its own. They were not connected, and now they're more integrated into the team. Now every operation guy and every developer has to be a security guy. Yeah, that's for sure. I think that Yuval is also saying another thing, that every security guy needs to be a little bit of a developer or operation guy.
Yeah. And, especially in the roles that are working in those areas. I mean, we do have, let's say, people that are more methodological and they work more on the compliance side and stuff like that. They do need to have an understanding. And if they had a better understanding, I think their role would be even more significant. Mm-hmm. But I think today in general, I even see it in the worlds of IT, in the worlds of BI, because now I'm running a few different teams. And so I think the ability to be able to develop, or I don't really want to call it develop, but be, let's say, one step up of, let's say, the scripts that we ran in the 90s, I think it's kind of, it'll bridge gaps, right? So I can give you a little use case. We use Okta as our IDP and kind of the infrastructure for our directory. And we wanted to basically know who has, what type of multi-factor they're using, because we started using push, we enabled push for all of our users to kind of simplify things. And then some of the first users registered with SMS. It's also known that that's not the most secure kind of 2FA. And we want to move from that to the push for everyone. Okta doesn't have a basic report that can put that out. They'll say, okay, here's the API. And now suddenly an IT person who wants to just know what type of multi-factor he's using, he needs to run an API query, pull all the users out, get their IDs. He needs to run another query on that ID that says, okay, what multi-factor is he using, and then filter out the ones that aren't using the right one. And you can't really call that development, but you do need to be able to write an API call to loop it and to run another API call on that. It's very simple, but it's a very basic kind of need that I think that everybody right now, that's at least my approach to things, everybody needs to have that ability to do. And I think also working into security and security automation, is the more you have those capabilities, I think the more you can do.
It is a developer's world, as Google was saying.
Right.
I agree.
So the last, we talked about technology, we talked about the people, the process. How do you change the process in the company so it will better fit your security challenges in this new microservices environment? I guess the first thing would be automation, right? You said that previously each developer had to, when he had to run a new service, he had to call the operation. So how do you do this again? Okay. What is your, how much freedom do you give to your developers, and where do you force them to comply to your policy, or where do you interfere when they started a new service?
So I think in general, something that is an overall kind of, and I said it before, but I think it's really important. It's something that, to be honest, it's not something that we security built the initiative. I think it was very much the DevOps who came with this culture, is let the developers work, let them do their job. They don't need us or security in the way to let them be able to do their job in a good way. We need to be silent partners, create the right controls to be able to let them do their work a lot faster, a lot quicker, which enables the company to scale. And this approach is something that changes fundamentally everything we do as security people. We like to be the kind of the door. We like to be able to approve everything on the way. And that's a core change for us. And I think it's a core change for the business. Developers, I think beforehand, they knew how to write the code, and they did in some way do the deployment, but they didn't really write the deployment scripts or anything that actually pushes the code into servers. This change really changed everything around it. It really brings up the developers and lets them say, you guys are in charge of your service. From the code to the operation to the scaling issues that it has, it really puts the operational burden back onto the developers. And this is something that, again, is very different from core enterprises, where you said developers don't go into production environments, right? So you have operational teams that go into a production environment. This methodology in the startups doesn't work. Not only does it not work, we actually think that it creates better developers when they have the knowledge, and also they understand how things run in production. They actually write better code. And so,
and if I connect it to the monolith, is really more difficult to do it. When it's microservice, you can give them
better freedom, because they are responsible for a smaller portion of
freedom and responsibility. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're responsible for a smaller part, they have less chances of screwing up the entire system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, we build out processes that says, okay, what does a developer need to spin up a new service? And so we started looking at all the different kind of aspects of it, from the Git repo, and we understood that we need to be able them to build out new Git repos and create the permissions on that. We looked at the underlying infrastructure, and so Kubernetes was basically chosen. And it was chosen for many, many reasons, but a lot of the reasons was that you can actually write a lot of code around the new microservice, build it as part of the service itself. So you can basically write as part of the microservice the specific specifications that you need. How many pods do you need? How does it scale? All of these things can be written as part of the microservice. And then the deployment is still something that I think the infrastructure of the deployment is still run by the DevOps team. So the CI and the CD is still run by the DevOps team, but the ability to use that now is much more simplified. And so today, a new developer who wants to spin up a new microservice can do that in a much more quicker way. He can get his repo, he can write his own Kubernetes configuration, and that's something that can actually push the microservice into production in a matter of hours, and instead of 4 or 5 days that he was doing before. And so that kind of increase in pace is something that's very important for the business. And also from a security perspective, we built in the different gates. Like I said, if it needs external traffic, we still need to be involved. We're now looking really much at the overarching environment of areas, which we didn't touch at this point. And that is if a new microservice needs a new S3 bucket, or if it needs a new queue on AWS, or it needs a new database. We want to be able to developers to do that. It's something right now that we're still doing centralized. And that needs a new architecting of our AWS architecture. And I think what AWS did with organizations now allows you to build out a better account strategy to, again, enable your developers to do a lot of the things that today DevOps are still doing.
Amazing. So we are running out of time here, even though I have a couple of other questions, but let me try to summarize this for a second. After that, I'll get back to you for the last sentence. So moving to Monolith, from Monolith to microservices, I think the biggest challenge, as you said, is not having the operations or the security as a bottleneck. In order to that, you dealt basically in three different aspects. From the technology point of view, you moved from an unmanaged Dockerized environment into a managed Kubernetes, which basically support your new environment. You have new management features that you are able to give permissions and let everybody basically build his own service without any interference. You managed to integrate this into your back office. You managed to integrate this into your front end, which is to your IT management, which is the Kubernetes. And this is, this is a good example of why unmanaged Docker is not microservices, as we said. From the people point of view, we need developers. We need people to at least understand development. They need to able to write a small script, basically troubleshoot or debug a certain script. This is a core capability in the next couple of years, not for developers, but also for IT, for operations. From a process point of view, the question is basically how much freedom should I give them versus to what responsibility should they have and how do I monitor them? And the idea here is that your guidelines are that a developer should be able to have his own microservice up and running without anybody's help. And in order to do that, you have your certain checkpoints or gateways that you need to move them across. And some of them they could do independently, and some of them they need your help. And basically, the line is shifting all the time. The border between what they can do independently and what you forces them to go with you goes. I mean, it's changing according to the maturity of the company and the maturity, I guess, of your programming infrastructure. This is a never-ending story. Interesting. Anything you want to say to close this up about the move?
I think it's really important for companies to understand why they want to change their architecture. The move to Kubernetes is a very complicated one. It brings in a lot of security challenges. Not only security challenges, it brings in a lot of operational and security challenges. I think today there's also many ways of doing a microservice architecture with less owning the infrastructure, with worlds of serverless and other areas that are kind of managed Kubernetes services. So it's really important to understand the maturity of the company, where they need to go before really jumping into this Kubernetes buzzword, because it's complicated and doesn't necessarily bring the value that it needs. So companies really need to evaluate why they're doing it, what their goals are, and to choose the right technology to get there.
Great.
Thank you very much, Yuval. Really interesting.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all the listeners for listening to Silverlining, the podcast for security and professional IT.